Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And hoo boy, do we have a season ender for you? Get right into it. Synopsize away, please.
Okay. I would say, do I have to?
I know, right?
Okay. It's called Believer.
Yeah.
When Reed receives a cryptic message leading him to a disgraced VICAP agent locked outside inside a Washington, D.C. storage unit, the BAU investigates his claims of an active serial killer nicknamed the Strangler, only to find themselves questioning everything they think they know after making a shattering revelation.
I love shattering revelations. Okay, so... It's hard to talk about this episode without knowing what's coming next, because we do know what's coming next. Like, we know what's going to be there in the season opener, right? Of next season.
Yeah.
So it's hard to pretend you don't know that. And the reason I bring it up is because, oh boy, does this episode... I'm so mad at this episode. And I think you know why. All right, so let's get into it. Owen, he's an FBI agent. I like they like a VICAP agent as if that's a special thing. No, he's an FBI agent. He works in VICAP, which, spoiler alert, the BAU is subservient to. Like, all the work you do is for, like, at the behest of the, you know, the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. Like, that's where your budget comes from, guys. Yet, again, you've got this weird scene where all of the people who work at VICAP have to come in and, you know, prostrate themselves before the BAU, who are the only real experts in any of this stuff.
Oh, and remember, Owen is just so jealous.
I know.
Because he can't be a profiler.
And that's the only kind of police work that really matters. Profile. Oh my god. It's just disgusting. But it's like the theme you talked about this year, where it's all about them lording it over people, and it's all about them not being able to be questioned for anything they do or say, right? That scene where everyone has to line up and talk about how great, like, they love Owen. We know you guys are the experts on this, and we obviously defer to you, but we think we're allowed to say that he couldn't be a serial killer because we all like him so much. Like, that scene is so bizarre. You know, it's so like, these are FBI agents. You don't have to ask permission from the BAU to have opinions about this stuff. It's kind of insulting that the show is pretending that you do. That the BAU is the arbiter of all of this. You know, that they're the ones who get to decide things.
Yeah, what the DP does isn't really sexual harassment.
What are you talking about?
Nothing. I'm just talking about the lawsuit.
Why? Oh, no, I see. Yes, because they're being quit. I see what you're saying. I'm not smart. Is the answer. Yeah, I'm not smart. But yeah, but it's just no, I was thinking about the episode and you, as is often the case, going right to that lawsuit. Because the lawsuit completely changes the story of this season. You're absolutely right. Because now it's a season about them saying, you don't get to tell us what to do. We tell you what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, well, if you know that they're being investigated for sexual harassment, it changes the tenor of the whole season, which it absolutely does. But
we're doing our retrospective.
No, you're absolutely right. But just this episode and that scene.
It was terrible.
It's terrible.
It is.
The way these characters are treated. Because like you said, they used to just treat, you know, cops this way.
Yeah.
It used to just be that cops couldn't be trusted and cops didn't understand things, and cops were just in the way of the smart people who were there to fix all of their problems if you stupid cops would just be smart enough to get out of the way, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you cops would just get out of the way, all of these problems would be solved instantaneously, is the show's feeling about cops. And now they're treating other people, the people in VICAP that way, which again is what the profiling program is a small part of. Like, all of the stuff about, you know how you solve every frigging crime by going through a list of similar crimes in America? You know how that's the number one thing you do? That's VICAP. You don't have that list if there's not a VICAP. If there aren't these agents cataloging every frigging crime in America, theoretically, obviously it's not every, but you're getting my point. Like, all of the crimes in America, there's no list for Penelope to base all of her work on. VICAP are the heroes that solve these crimes. You're just the showboats who get all the credit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm sorry. It just really pisses me off how they treat VICAP in this episode.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't disagree with you in the least.
The idea that they're like, oh, well, it is obviously a lesser condition than being a profiler. Everyone knows being a profiler is the only job worth having in the FBI. Jesus Christ, this show. It's always bad, but this episode is real bad.
This is where it really comes home to roost.
Oh, absolutely.
Is all I can say.
All of the arrogance, all of the bad behavior, all of the, you know, all of the terrible treatment of other law enforcement agents, it's like all contained in this one god-awful scene where they're just, you know, everybody has to come and beg them to, like, treat Owen well. Because he couldn't be a bad guy. I mean, obviously, we don't know, because we're just VICAP people. But, you know, you gotta try to, you know, you gotta listen to us. Please, Mr. Profiler, whose opinion is somehow very important. So, yeah, this episode pissed me off. And it pissed me off more later. It pissed me off a lot. The reveals that come next year, which we're going to talk about next year, I'm not going to get into it now, make this episode so, like, it's a terrible episode. It becomes so much worse in retrospect.
Yeah.
After you get the reveals next year.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the episode is bad enough because it is rather confusing.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's supposed to, now, I will give it this, it's supposed to leave you confused.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because like
it's such a weird cliffhanger. Situation.
It's a weird situation. It's the cliffhanger.
Yeah.
You know, so that
you're supposed to be, yeah, you're supposed to be excited to see where they do it this next year, and you're supposed to be left on the edge of your feet, your seat.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, but, oh my god, the places this thing goes. So anyway, Owen gets found in a storage unit, and he gets sent there, Reed gets sent there to check it out, because he gets sent Owen, like, a photocopy of Owen's badge. And it's a big deal. As we discussed last year in A Badge and a Gun, it's kind of a big deal for an FBI agent to not have their badge. I don't know why he did still have his badge, because he quit the FBI. Yeah. They don't let you keep your badge, but let's just say he still had his badge. For some reason, he still has his badge.
And it doesn't say retired or withdrawn.
Yeah, because, you know,
even my freaking old passports say that.
Yeah, no, they have to stamp on there so you can't use them anymore. But let's overlook that part. I mean, that's what I talked about. I mean, it's like I talked about that in the A Badge and a Gun episode, that they don't let you keep your badge when you retire. They have a giant, you know, press. I don't know if they still do the thing, but they used to have a stamp press that would literally cut holes that spell out the word retired all the way through the badge so it could not conceivably be used. They didn't just put in a stamp, they actually perforated the entire badge with the word retired just so you could not conceivably ever use that badge for any reason again. They take this stuff seriously.
Yeah.
So yes, the idea that he still had his badge after quitting the FBI seems a little strange, but give them that. So they go there. They search the place, and they find Owen. He's in real bad shape, and he claims he's been held hostage for a whole year by crazy murderers.
Yeah.
Right? And they never think, how did the crazy murderers find, like, a thing that would have saved them a lot of heartache is if they had thought for even 1 second, how did the crazy murderers find and identify you?
Yeah.
Like, you were literally just hanging out in bars. How did they know you were looking for them? There's a good reason for it in the plot. Well, it's not a good reason, but there's a reason. But the characters don't question for a second how they found out about him. Because a guy hanging out in a college bar, you wouldn't think, it's not like he was going and asking people questions. Hey, have you heard about this strangler? Hey, do you know there's a strangler running around? Be careful about this strangler. Like, he didn't do any of that, so how did they find him and know to kill him? Well, kidnap him. And the answer is, well, there's no answer. there is no answer until next year we find out, oh, it was somebody in the FBI who did it. We actually found out at the end of the season.
At the end of this episode.
Yeah, yeah, but why didn't the characters question it is what I didn't understand.
Yeah, why didn't they question it right off the top?
Yeah, how could they have possibly found out that this guy was looking into their cult when he wasn't in the FBI completely dismissed the idea that this killer was out there, right? And then he quit to keep searching for it. So there was no one providing oversight to it. He wasn't going on the web and talking about it. So how did they know? Should have been 100. The second they realized he was actually abducted, the question, how did they know to abduct him, should have been at the forefront of their minds. It should have been the only question they wanted answered. And they would have, you know, solved it almost right immediately.
Then we wouldn't have had a cliffhanger.
Well, we shouldn't have had a cliffhanger anyway, but I'll get there.
Never mind.
We'll get there. Seriously, though, no. It's unbelievably frustrating how half-assed they do this. So then we get the journey of, I'm going to say it, and if I'm going too far, I often go too far. So if I'm going too far this time, feel free to call me on it. The most cleanly heroic person in the history of this show? Theo? Like, the most, just the best person who has ever been a character on this show. The character who, despite being raised by literal serial-killing psychopaths, managed to find enough humanity to save the lives of two people and kill a bunch of serial killers and try to unwind the cult he was a part of. Am I being hyperbolic to say, call him the best person they've ever encountered on the show?
Let me think about that one for a while. But I do, within the context of this episode, for sure.
He's a hero.
Yeah.
I mean, first off, he's a hero. But beyond that, he's just a good person. He has managed to overcome his, like, all of the stuff he was taught by his horrible parents as a child. He has managed to overcome all of that and save a huge number of lives. Because I want to point out, it's not like they were going to keep right on killing people. You know, they haven't stopped killing people. Like, Theo's decision to kill his parents and save his girlfriend and Owen saves tons of lives. And he did all of that himself.
Okay, with, like, but we don't
no
know
external
that
support.
Yet.
No, we know that, well, no, but I mean, we know that there's a, by the end of the episode, we know that there's an enormous cult going around killing people.
Yes, but we still think Owen saved everybody.
Well, no, kind of, but it's like clearly Theo, at the end of the episode, we see what really happened, that Theo choked Owen out so he could get his hands on the gun and then murder his parents. We do see that that happened. We see that Theo is the hero here. And then he kills the guys in the subway, and you're like, why'd he kill those guys? And we find out that, oh, okay, they were cultists too.
And they were looking for him.
And they were trying to put the bag on him. And so when I get to the end of the episode, and I'm just going to skip ahead, I am full on disgusted by the fact that Spencer Reed sacrificed Owen's life to save Penelope Garcia. Because that's what happens. He gets caught in a situation where you have to sacrifice Penelope's life, or you have to betray the FBI and put Owen's family, and the and Theo at risk, and you have to let a serial killer go. And what does Spencer Reed do? He betrays the FBI, he lets a serial killer go, all to save Penelope Garcia, who is, and I can't stress this enough, a much worse person than Theo. I got a real problem with this episode.
Well, yeah.
I have a pretty huge problem with this episode, in fact. I'm still not over it all this time later. Like, literally, I was so shocked that it's like, here is a person who has overcome one of the worst possible upbringings, and he came out of it the kind of guy who would put his life at risk to save people, right? Who literally puts his, I mean, yeah, it's just people he cares about, but he's still putting his life at risk to save people and take down a giant cult. You know, he's putting in the effort and he's trying to save the day. And you say, well, what do you call it? That's all Spencer Reed was doing. He's trying to save Penelope. Yeah. But the thing is, Owen wasn't trading an innocent person's life for the people he wanted to save.
Yeah.
And that's what Spencer Reed is doing. He is risking the lives of innocent people to save a friend of his. And spoiler alert, the innocent people die. Well, at least one. Like, but the hero, the most innocent person, the most heroic person in this situation gets killed because of Spencer Reed's actions. And there's no nice way to put, like, there's no nice way to frame it. There's no better way to say, well, really what he meant to, or, oh, he could have pulled it off in so-and-so. He is told, turn the serial killer and Theo over to a cult, and he doesn't. Because he wants to save Garcia. And he loves Garcia. And these people all love each other and all best friends and family and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Well, we know how I all feel about all that.
We've been very open about our feelings towards the sick codependent relationship that these people have with each other. But it's all right there in the episode. Like, I can understand why someone say, oh, well, you're being hyperbolic. You're being too mean to Spencer Reed. But, like, he is given a choice. Sacrifice innocent lives for your friend. And he signs up to sacrifice innocent lives for his friends. And maybe he's so frigging arrogant that he believes he can think his way out of it and end up saving people's lives, even if he trades those people for his friend. But his arrogance doesn't win at the end, and he doesn't succeed. And he will never be called to account for this decision. Ever.
By anyone.
This episode, by anyone. Yeah, this episode troubles me. I'm so mad at this episode. Well, they spend the whole episode, you know, like, in this weird David Lynch headspace that they are quite, I think, quite fairly skeptical of Owen's story, because according to Owen's story, he was living in blue velvet, you know. the sick, strange stuff going on just underneath the the pleasant look of suburbia. That's essentially what's happening in this episode. Turns out he was living in blue velvet the whole time.
And we didn't know.
I know, right?
Yeah.
What a huge surprise. Yeah, blue velvet was happening right outside the city this whole time. I know, and it's frustrating to me, right? As I watch the episode, because you're like, you spend all of this time in this weird, almost fantasy world with Owen. And then we find out that all of, like, his crazy stories were all true. They were murderous psychopaths. They did cut people's, burn people's fingers off, fingerprints off. And they did, like, strangle people to death and cut out the strangulation bone. Like, all of that stuff that he said, like, all of the crazy stuff he tells them turns out to be 100% true. And so you're like, so all of, it's kind of weird because we're in this position where they spend so much of the episode being suspicious of him and doubting him. right?
Yeah.
And then it all, like, even the craziest stuff, all, every word of it turns out to be true. And you're like, oh, okay, so half the episode was just, you know, treading water until we got to the reveal. That seems like a bit of a disappointment.
Yeah, and because who understands? Like, it doesn't make any sense. They don't handle it the way the BAU is supposed to handle it. It's that simple.
Not at all.
You know, I mean, they shouldn't be skeptical of this. I mean, how many weird serial killers have they met in their lives who do bizarre things? How many cults have they been involved with, right?
Enough is the answer.
And these horrible megalomaniacs, and, well, of which they've become part, but
that's true.
It's another story.
Yeah, they themselves have fallen victim to that kind of worldview.
And you just go, why did you? Well, I guess because they needed. Well, see, it's really hard to kind of talk about this without talking about
the reveals in the second half.
The reveals in the second half. It makes it very, very difficult.
Which is why we're not going to get into this too long. You're absolutely right. We'll have enough to say when we see y'all back here in 2 weeks for the. For the follow-up to this, which is, hoo doggy, is, you thought this was bad? Wait until you see the follow-up. What I really want to do is just register, before we get into it in 2 weeks, I just want to register my disgust with some of the ways the story has developed. Because what it comes right down to is, and I know people are like, oh, why are you so prioritizing how great this Theo character is, and I'll tell you why. Literally because this is a show about how people are tied up with the abuse that happened to them as children, and how that abuse defines them, right? That is such a central theme of this show.
Yep.
So the hopefulness that is inherent in Theo's story is so, like, unusual for this show, and it's so positive for this show. And the fact that the show just craps all over that.
Yeah.
And here's the thing that I didn't really think about the first time, right? But watching this, I could not avoid the realization that, like, we're going to talk about how stupid the plot is in a second, okay? We're going to get there. Don't worry. But the thing that puzzled me when I was watching it was, oh my god, did... So if you think about it this way, Theo went to Spencer because undoubtedly... So he's, he's watching Spencer do his teaching a course, and he's learning about criminology or whatever it is Spencer's teaching. I have no idea what he's teaching, but that's not important. What is important is he's learning, and he sees... because there's no way Spencer's not talking about this, he sees what Spencer has been through in the past year, right?
Right.
Before teaching. Because it was huge national news. FBI agent, jailed for murder. Oh, it was a setup by a serial killer. Blah, blah, blah. Like, this was all huge national news, and now that man is teaching him. And so he knows this man has been through a hell that few people on Earth can compare to. Right? Falsely accused of murder by a serial killer, sent to jail as an FBI agent, life completely turned upside down and messed up, but he manages to get through it, and now he's teaching a course and he's back in the FBI. Well, you have to imagine that the reason he's fixated on Reed, right, is that it inspired him.
And he thinks there might be a way out.
Exactly. Reed's life story has shown him that there's a way out. Yeah, talking to Owen helped, but you have to imagine that seeing Reed as an example of a guy who has this screwed up backstory, but has managed to get through it and is back at the FBI and is back at his job and is vindicated. And he's the kind of person who fights these monsters anyway. You put all that together and it's like, obviously, he sees Spencer Reed as someone to emulate or idolize, and that's why he reaches out to him to deal with the cult and save Owen. And so the fact, and it's like, this is all going into our book about Spencer Reed, obviously.
Yeah.
The fact that the end result of that is that Spencer Reed then betrays him and gets him killed. Just, it adds this extra level of agonizing tragedy to this kid's story.
Okay, yes, I know.
No, I know I'm going too far with it. I get that, but I just think there's something unbelievably interesting. Well, no, I don't know that you're going... But I'm getting too much into next year, yes.
Yeah, what you're doing is getting into next year.
I know, you're absolutely right. But you understand, I mean, you've already said it's hard to talk about. So, you're right, we'll stop talking about the arc of this story and how badly done by the Theo character is by the
writers.
I mean, no, it gets worse.
The thing is, this episode is bad enough,
yeah.
Then it only gets worse.
It only gets worse. But it's just the fact that his narrative is one of the most hopeful things the show has ever done. And then it gets abandoned. And that's crazy to me. But then again, follow up on people trying to make their lives better isn't something the team is good at, which is going to come up in season 14. Is it ever?
Because the team doesn't make up.
No.
That doesn't make their lives better.
No, they don't. So how could they possibly help anybody else?
You know.
There's going to be a lot of that to talk about next year. So let's just talk about how this episode makes zero sense. Why doesn't Theo just phone Spencer Reed? Why does he go through this unbelievably elaborate game of cat and mouse? And he's like, I left you all the clues.
Clues, yeah.
In the thing. Instead of clues, why not just leave a note?
Why not just come up to him after class?
Or come up to him after... Well, no, I mean, he didn't... they tried to murder her. Like, this all happened suddenly. Like, they tried to murder his girlfriend. The parents tried to murder his girlfriend. And so it all went down because that happened the day before yesterday. But the thing is, so he can't just do it casually in a class because he doesn't fully turn on his family until they try to get him to murder his girlfriend, right? But once they've tried to get you to murder your girlfriend and you've turned on your family... Why don't you just phone Spencer Reed?
Yeah.
You know, or if you don't want to phone him, if you're worried that they have people inside the cops or the FBI, and you want Spencer Reed to rescue Owen, why not, while Spencer Reed is finding Owen and rescuing him, Spencer Reed finds a frigging little journal that laying out what the cult is and who's in it?
Something.
Why not make some effort to communicate? What's this? I left you all of the clues. You left him a few bones that were labeled.
Yeah. Well, you know what the other interesting thing is?
Yeah.
Though, is that who knows what Reed said about himself and his love of puzzles and the different things in the class that he was taking, right? I can just see.
Oh, no. But the thing is, if it was a serial killer trying to play games with Reed because of his class, that's fine. This is a guy trying to escape a cult and save his and his girlfriend's and an FBI agent's life. And he's playing games and he's leaving clues instead of just saying what the problem is and asking for help. No, that makes no sense. And there's no way to fix this script to make it make sense.
No, I know.
You can understand why he can't just walk in the door, because he's afraid that these people have infiltrated with the FBI, which, spoiler alert, they have. But he can just write down everything and give it to Owen to give to Reed.
Okay, now, the first thing I am going to tell you...
Please.
If you have not... You now have it in front of you, but...
I do.
Just remember... Look at the writer and the director. The two of the named defendants in the lawsuit after Erica Messer.
All right. So they were distracted, is your point?
Because
they had other stuff on their mind.
Breen does a better job.
He does. That's my point. Breen usually does a better job than
we may not always like what he writes, but he does a better job. And yes. Glenn Kershaw is considered one of the best directors.
Absolutely.
Right? We've said this before. Now we've got the two of them as two of the named people.
Defendants. Yeah.
Defendants, right? As opposed to, like, there's the corporation, but there's four individuals named.
Yes.
Five individuals technically named. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that is an issue. Yeah. So you're right. They probably had some other stuff on their mind than doing a good job this week.
Well, no, I mean, and this goes to this whole season, because I don't know that talking any more about this episode really.
No, I mean, we'll have a lot to say about this episode next season.
Mm-hmm.
In
2 weeks, we'll just rip this thing apart.
Yeah, we absolutely will.
I mean, because it's just so.
No. When you get to the reveal next season, it's one of the worst things they've ever done. Fun fact, the one good thing, though, Michael Hogan's in it. I'm Michael Hogan. Famous Canadian actor Michael Hogan.
Yeah.
Star of Battlestar Galactica and 800 other things.
Yes.
Plays the cult leader. Second
only to Michael Ironside.
Yeah, for just like the Canadian tough guy you always want to see. Yeah, no, way to go, Michael Hogan. Cash that check. You're the best. All right, so let's look at the season as a whole. Now we're going to start with the easiest thing, which is, easiest thing. The easiest thing, picking a worst episode this year. It's not easy at all. It's really hard to do.
Yeah, because I think we're probably in agreement that of all the episodes that the only one that we really enjoyed was Adam Rodriguez's episode.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Within that episode, you still get that unpleasant misogynist crap and blah, 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 but.
Yeah.
It's genuinely an entertaining episode, and the many, 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 many jokes at the show's expense.
Yes.
So. Are delightful for us to watch. And again, it validated the opinion of a script I wrote 10 years ago by saying that profiling is just PR.
Yeah.
Like that felt amazing for me as a longtime viewer. And, you know, super obsessive about the film. Like, I felt like I was being heard by the show. It felt great.
Well,
all right, I may be overstating this a little.
Yeah, well, I will wait and see, because I have season 13 and season 14.
I have. Please tell me. I hope if he does a commentary, I'll buy it, too, and listen to his commentary.
Yeah, well,
because I need to know.
Wait, I'm taking them out of the library.
Okay, no, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'll buy them. So, I'm not going to get them from you. You're taking them out of the library.
No. But they're not I can't get them, I think, till July 10th or something.
Oh, okay.
So unless that person brings them back sooner.
Let's just say we might do a special episode just about Adam Rodriguez commentary if it proves to be as entertaining as his episode was.
I'm not sure that there are commentaries. I know there are special features on both things, but just thought I have to go and see if there are commentaries and stuff.
But top of the season, best thing, there's no competition. It's Adam Rodriguez's episode, because it's still a crappy episode of Criminal Minds, but everything around that crappy episode of Criminal Minds is just super entertaining.
Oh, yes.
It's so funny. Like, just to be able to say, yeah, I know I'm on a stupid show. Let's comment on that. Let's
have
some fun
with
it. Please.
Okay, I have a question.
I love questions.
So these episodes are 2017 and 2000. And, the guy doesn't get fired till 2018. So that's something we have to look for in 2018.
Yeah.
Does the visual style of the show change?
Change in a meaningful way. Yeah, that's amazing. Wondering if he was still there. Yes, he's still there.
He's still there. Yeah, he's still here.
Okay.
So, right? So Glenn Kershaw and Breen Frazier did the first episode and they did the last episode.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Erica's done a bunch of shows and written a bunch in between.
Surprising, no one.
It starts off, it's not too bad.
Yeah.
If I was to talk about the season as a whole, it's just once you get to False Flag,
mm-hmm.
and then
it goes off the rails.
It starts to go off the rails. Like, the last half of this season is just
bonkers.
Insane.
Yeah.
It's bonkers. Like even Dust and Bones, for example, you know, the snake one.
Yeah.
Right. You know, okay, maybe it's not a Criminal Minds episode particularly.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's not, but it's not a bad.
A bad half hour, hour of television overall.
42 minutes of television.
42 minutes of television. Yeah.
You know, like, there are some of these things.
I mean, that's a funny example, because it's like, it's an okay story about this abused woman.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be the second best episode this year, about this abused woman taking it out, like, taking out her anger on her mother at the wrong people.
Yeah.
Right? This horrible mother who ruined her childhood and then just got to walk away and have a do-over. Well, of course she can't let that go. Of course she can't get away from that. And so she, like Hannibal would tell her to, find the thing that you want to become and become that thing.
Yes.
Like, yeah, it's like, you don't feel at home in yourself, figure out what you are and become that thing. By the way, I don't think it's healthy to refer, like, it's healthy for the community to refer to Hannibal as the most accepting of the trans community show ever, but it 100% is. Hannibal would have been the perfect therapist if you're dealing with gender dysmorphia. Like, he is all in on getting you to be the person you need to be. And I know that because he helped one guy turn into a wolf. And no, I'm not equating gender dysmorphia with people who think they're wolves. It was a joke about how Hannibal is wonderful. I'm sorry if that was offensive. That was clearly not my intention.
No, that's not what you meant. No,
clearly
no, it's
not what
the
I
idea,
meant.
The idea that people, if he wasn't a serial killer and didn't eat people,
he would be the best therapist in the world.
He could have been, he could potentially have been the best therapist in the world.
100%.
Right? However, he wasn't.
We're and, probably going to watch Hannibal for this at some point, aren't we? I just realized we're probably going to watch Hannibal for this at some point.
Yeah, at some point. Because in some ways, it.
It's an antidote for Criminal Minds.
Well, because it's very strange. The TV series is what we're talking about, not the movies.
No. We've already covered
the movies. Oh, God.
They're not great.
So boring.
Yeah.
Even the second one is boring.
Yeah. No, Manhunter's the only really good movie in there, as we established on our episode about that. I love that we didn't even think we needed to talk about the movie Hannibal. Because you don't.
We did an episode with Hannibal.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the first movie called? Is it just called
Red Dragon? Sorry, Manhunter.
Manhunter
is the first one.
Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, Silence of the Lambs is the one that is massively overrated, according to us.
Yes, but you know, I mean, the book is much better. So
absolutely.
We've already discussed that.
Yeah, you can listen to our episode if you want to hear.
Yeah, but two and three, like the other handles, and even the book was.
That third book is not great.
Let's get back to this. We're looking at all of these, right?
Yes.
And trying to figure out. The problem is that trying to figure out which is the worst, probably, okay, I'm going to say probably False Flag.
Yeah.
In some ways, because it leads to the massive disintegration of the last half of the episode. Of the season.
It is the point at which the narrative of the season becomes, we are misunderstood geniuses.
Yes.
And everyone is persecuting us because we're too good at our jobs. It becomes a show about arrogant people refusing to accept responsibility for their actions and expecting to be celebrated for that refusal to accept responsibility for their actions.
Well,
it's not enough that they're horrible people. They expect everyone to applaud the horrible things they say and do.
Well, yeah. And as I said, and it's really hard not to think in terms
of the lawsuit,
because the first guy, Matulik, is fired in 2017.
Yeah. So while this is all going on.
Right. And so all of this stuff is going on. And then they're just sitting here in the last half.
Writing episode after episode. About how they shouldn't be questioned.
They shouldn't be questioned, and they shouldn't. You can have the most hostile work environment that you possibly can have.
Yep.
Right? And it doesn't matter because we're producing something wonderful.
Yep.
No, that isn't how it works. That isn't how it works. Or at least, let me put it this way. That isn't how it should work.
Yeah, that's the more honest way to say it.
You know, because it's not like this is the first, or nor will it, I suspect, be the last. But
no.
It it is changing. And this lawsuit may change a lot of things depending on how it ends up and just how much CBS and ABC and everybody else is going to have to fork over, which is why Mark Gordon's company, they must have just handed over money and left all control. That's all, because they're not in the lawsuit, period.
Yeah, no. Generally, that's not strange for it to work. Like, they originally developed the show. They, you know, they are the middle ground of the thing, but they're not involved in the day-to-day in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
That is my sense of how the Mark Gordon company works. Because, I mean, the Mark Gordon company, it's like, they make so many TV shows, they wouldn't have time to care about what was going on.
They don't care. Yeah, nobody would ever tell them what's going on. Yeah. Anyway, the other thing is, though, that I would say is, in terms of the worst episodes, like there's different criteria for what makes the worst
overall,
episode.
Yeah, it's like, for the damage it does to the show as a whole, yes.
Yeah.
False flag, 100% the worst show. But it's not, I mean... Okay, it's also probably the dumbest episode.
But it's not.
Because the plot makes no sense.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have these episodes that are aggressively stupid and don't understand how the world works, like Lucky Strikes and...
I was just going to say.
Yeah, Lucky Strikes and Killer App, which were back to back.
I know. And Lucky Strikes is even worse because of the whole business with Shamar Moore.
Oh, I know.
That just made me... Well, you will have all listened to how I thought about what I
that
thought about
scene.
That.
Yeah, where Shamar Moore comes back to talk about how strong
after
his baby girl
her.
Is.
Yeah,
after ignoring everybody her. For a year.
And her, when she's just falling apart.
Yeah. And it's like, and the realization that she has never gotten therapy because of what she went through. You got shot and you almost died. And you
and
never
Shamar
got any therapy.
Shamar tells you, you're strong, baby girl.
Jesus.
Oh, you're okay.
But I mean, that's a very insulting thing for the character.
The whole thing. I mean, that would probably, if I was to say everything, because like you have to kind of pick, okay, what pissed you off the most?
No, and I would say that if in a season... where they didn't write this aggressively stupid episode that also had that also led them down the path of the show becoming actively terrible.
Yeah.
Like in a season where a false flag didn't exist, you know, that stuff with Shamar Moore, with Derek and Penelope alone could have made this be considered the worst episode of the season.
Yeah.
That's how bad this season was, that it managed to do worse than Lucky Strikes.
Yeah. And I think what happens with a lot of... Yeah, so Lucky Strikes is your second worst.
Totally, And then Killer App. Which is an episode that doesn't understand how anything works. Guns, drones, mercenaries, the government. Like, it's a show that literally understands how nothing works. It is living in a bizarre fantasy world.
I know. It's like...
Yeah. That is an insane episode of television.
And we've talked about all of these. And I keep looking at it, right?
Yeah.
And I keep going... okay, well, what's... At the beginning, you know, like I'm looking at all of these other episodes, right?
Yeah.
And going, okay, it's not like they were great. There were a lot of them, and that was the problem. A lot of them felt, and it was an increasing problem. Because when I look back at the beginning of this season, it's just run-of-the-mill problems to some extent. Most of them could be fixed a little bit or whatever, right? Maybe. Right? Mm-hmm. But not too bad, but it just starts to get worse. But there are so many of these episodes as we're going along that I'm going, God, they're like first drafts.
Yeah.
How many times did I say that? Or this needs another two or three rewrites. And normally it's fairly easy for us to rewrite episodes.
Yeah. But so many of these episodes are just, you have to throw them away. You have to tear down the whole episode. Throw it all away.
Yeah. It needs a major overhaul.
Yeah.
You have to take the key like the core statement about what the episode is supposed to be about, mm-hmm. throw everything out and then rewrite it.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're not going to do that, I'll tell you.
Of course not. But I mean, there's no better example of that than the episode Full Tilt Boogie, which started out with with Erica Messer and Kristen Vangsna saying, we've got to say something about the opioid crisis. And then they had no idea what to say. And then but no one noticed that they had zero idea what they wanted to say about the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
And you end up with an episode that says nothing and does it badly. There is an episode that literally says, these opioids might be the worst serial killer we've ever come across. To which I respond, the opioids didn't kill anybody. The drug companies killed people. That's like saying, these knives. Like, that is like saying, you know, serial killers cut up a lot of women with knives. Knives might be the worst serial killer we've ever come across.
Yeah,
that is the level of thought that has gone into this.
But that's a general thought. Yeah, but I'm not. Am I surprised? No, because that is the way society tends to deal with drugs.
They blame the addict.
And remember, America, like I just wrote that fan of our listener.
One of
ours,
our listeners, yes.
Us, right? And part of it is if you could just deal with sort of gun culture, right? Yeah. But it's an attitude about drugs that is different than the attitude about knives and guns.
Mm-hmm.
I know, but although they treat guns more like opioids and no, they don't. Yes.
No,
guns.
Not the same way.
No, guns don't kill people. People kill people.
And in the same way, it's not that a giant corporation wanted to make $1 billion. It's that, you know, 500 people a week who are killing themselves with opioids, they're all just individually people who don't have the self-control necessary to get off of opioids.
Yeah, that's where it's sort of...
It's a little similar to the gun debate, I will agree with you.
Yeah, you know, so it's not, don't expect anybody in authority to mm-hmm. be responsible for what they're supposed to be responsible
for.
Exactly. I.e., okay, now I've brought it back to the friggin' lawsuit again.
Yep.
I can't help it.
It's hard to not think. I mean, I'm not gonna argue with you. It's hard to not think about the lawsuit.
I'm talking about this and then I'm going, okay, yeah, but that was the upper management of this show.
Yeah, every time you dig into this season's themes, the lawsuit just happens. It just comes up. You can't get away from it.
I mean, honestly,
anyone would agree. We've tried to get away from it. We have attempted to not talk about this lawsuit, but the show keeps pulling us back in.
Yeah, and you can't. It's when we start talking about the show and what we see in the show, and then you just go, "Okay, that's what it is."
Yeah,
and that, you know, individuals are responsible for their behavior. You don't have a corporate, you know. Well, exactly. It is this business of Black Lives Matter. There's no systemic racism.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, there's not a law that says Black people, can't do X, Y, or Z, which means there must be no systemic racism, as if laws are the only kind of system that exists. As if the concept of behavioral norms doesn't exist in these people's heads.
Yeah, and you know, cops, no, they're not responsible.
They treat black lives as disposable.
It's weird.
That's why it's called Black Lives Matter. Because cops treat black lives as if they are disposable and meaningless. It's not complicated. But these people pretend it's complicated. And they pretend, I don't see in the law books where it says a white cop can shoot a black person and get away with it. So it must not be happening.
Yeah, it must not be happening. And Jesus. You can see it, you know, you can just see it again and again and again. But this episode, it's funny, eh? I mean, and then all of a sudden you're just going, yeah, that's exactly it. That the people that are supposed to be, who are in authority, mm-hmm. do not want to be held responsible for their behavior.
That's what it is. And it goes back, it's this episode, it's all the episodes, it's the Black Queen, you know? Yeah. Like, it's this narrative running through the whole season where they shouldn't be held responsible for the consequences of their actions. And imagine how much more powerful it would have been if they had gone through with their original plan, what clearly is their original plan, and she had actually shot that guy.
You mean in False Flag?
In False Flag. Yeah. Imagine how much stronger the them trying to avoid the consequences of their actions narrative would become had they done the episode the way it obviously was meant to be done.
Yeah, but this show cannot do that because the showrunner,
they can't critique. No, you're right. The character and the showrunner are one and the same at this point.
Yeah.
Like, she is, I mean, I don't know her level of involvement, and I'm not going to, for legal reasons, suggest her level of involvement in harassment or covering up for it, because there's a lawsuit going on that we are going to wait for the outcome of. But we're saying that narratively, they had to feel like they were under scrutiny, and they believe that a scrutiny is unfair. And as a result, she becomes Emily Prentice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, from a narrative standpoint, Emily Prentice is the showrunner.
Yeah, it's really weird.
You're exactly right about that.
You know, I know, I mean, you tried harder. Like, I finally gave up after. Yeah. Like, not in the first few, like, not in the beginnings of the episode, of course, and you don't know too much, like, because the lawsuit comes in the middle of, when we're doing end of 12, beginning of 13 or something. I can't remember exactly where it fits in with when we do these episodes, right?
Right.
But it certainly is here a weird thing that is it's infected the show.
Yeah. It has become unlike an integral part, this desire to evade responsibility for your actions has become an integral part of the show's DNA.
Yeah.
We are right and we should be deferred to and no one can question us is now a central part of the show in a way that it never was before.
And explains things for the last 13 years.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, totally. I mean, that's basically what happens is that there are questions, and I'm going to have to go back and listen to earlier shows that later on when we do our retrospective after 15
of the whole show, right?
Of the show as a whole, and some of the questions I had, as I said, I think a few weeks ago, okay, well, I guess I can't really blame Scientology anymore.
I know.
Libertarianism in Maybe. This idea of individual rights, because I can just hear them. Like, I know what people who have who create these hostile work environments, how they say things. Well, yeah, but you know, so-and-so didn't matter. I just listened to some guy talking about something else, right? And it's just like, well, nobody complained or they liked it. Well, no, you don't know because you are in such a position of power that even if she did like it, she couldn't tell you.
She is not able to say no.
She is putting
I assume you're talking about Matt Lauer here.
Actually, no.
And his claim that everything was consensual.
His
predation on all of the interns at the Today Show over a decade was every single thing was consensual because none of them, you know, scratched out his eyes when he tried to coerce them into giving him a blowjob. Well, none of them ever called me a rapist and scratched out my eyes, so obviously it was all consensual.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's, I mean, and you hear men talking sometimes about these sorts of things.
Yeah.
All right, it's not, I'm not going to say that there aren't women predators. There clearly are, but they are way down low on the
scale,
the numbers, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm not, you know, so don't get me wrong there, but I'm going. Men, power has always been more important to men.
Absolutely.
Than to women. And because, right? And then it changes, right? I mean, there are side issues with the feminist movement. And when we ask for equal rights, do we become men?
Yeah.
Because that is the model.
Or do you blaze a new trail of what power looks like and what authority looks like?
Yeah, and that's the hard one. And I think it's the same thing for people who are Black or who are Latino.
Yeah.
Yes, some of them are just going to bow right into, okay, the normative narrative.
Yeah, when you get put in authority, you act like, you know, white people have always acted.
Well, this is what authority looks like. And yeah. and before the British Empire took over the world, okay, because that's where...
No, that's really, where this comes from, absolutely.
Well, I mean, that is, first you had Roman Catholicism, and that took over basically Europe, and then you end up with the British Empire taking over the world and spreading a vision of power, yeah. Right? That is a normative, and it's always been there. Like, I mean, I'm going to be teaching friggin' online. I don't know how it's going to work. I'm not, you know, I mean, I really don't know how this is going to work, me teaching online, but we'll see.
It should be a fun experiment.
Well, yes, your point. But I'm doing ancient Egypt. I'm doing the ancient Near East. But, you know, so there's always good and bad. And like the British Empire, there was a lot of good things about some of the ideas. And, you know, if you value education. So what do you want to do? Go back? No, education is important. The content of the education is the issue, right? Is reading most, like, there's all sorts of things, but it basically, so when you have all of these equal rights movements, what do they mean? And how
what is the outcome you are trying to reach?
Yeah. And, you know, so it, and it's really hard to come up with a different outcome, which is why you always see slippage.
So
after there have been,
I think, let me say this in the most concise possible way, and we'll get back. White supremacy and male and toxic masculinity is the water we all swim in as fish.
Yeah.
So when a movement says we're going to move to land, a huge number of people have real problems figuring out what land is.
Yeah. And
that's what's going on with the defund. I mean, as we're talking now, the defund police movement is getting a lot of traction, and people are so wrapped up in their idea of that the media has sold them as cops as heroes and police and order as being an inherent good, blah, 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 in America, that they can't even imagine that you could have something else, despite the fact that friggin' 50 other countries in the world have cops that don't carry guns, and all of those countries have less crime.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't become the Purge when you take away cops' guns. It just becomes a place where cops don't shoot people for no reason.
And you have control over guns as well. Exactly. Like, I think, I mean, I honestly think, like, I was thinking about that this morning.
Yeah.
And I'm going, you know, you just get rid of the friggin' gun. I mean, the best thing that happened after that asshole went on the rampage in Nova Scotia in the middle of COVID-19, just after it started, right? But he'd been working on this for 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah,
right?
He was planning his massacre.
He was planning this kind of massacre anyway. And, but I mean, the first thing they did was, okay, we're going to get rid of those types of guns.
Yeah,
okay,
they're just
that's
gone.
It. Bunk. They're gone. You've got a minority, but the two minority parties are in full agreement, so you can do it. Okay, but now we get to the rest of it in Canada. But I mean, Canada doesn't have as big a gun problem as the United States, where everybody has a gun, and you still see some of these politicians. Well, yeah, of course I carry a gun. You know, and you're just looking there. What the frig do you need a gun for? You have got all sorts of people around. Well, you know, just in case I get in problems. Why do you need guns?
Yeah.
No, if you started to ban guns and you pulled them away, you would have a big way to start shifting the vision. Because you have to get rid of more than Gone with the Wind. You have to get rid of the mythology of the friggin' West that I taught in the winter term. That has
the weird part is, I know this is crazy, the mythology of the West is more important. I'd be fine with them keeping Gone with the Wind, because I hate the presentation of Black people in it. It's disgusting. But at the same time, that is a movie about how everyone in the South was an awful person.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, yeah. All of the characters are awful people, except Rhett Butler, who's the only one who's criticizing the South's preconceptions. But even he turns out to be a scumbag rapist.
Yeah, and in real life and in the movie.
In real life and in the movie. Yeah. But it's like, even he turns, like, it's, they're all terrible people. Yeah. It is not a pro-South movie. Like, it
No, it's not. Except that people...
the symbols. The symbols are too powerful.
Yeah, and that's the problem. And it is such a beautiful movie.
It is gorgeous.
And the balls. And when you read McCarthy's book, right? You read the book, right? And it, for her, it's this loss.
Yeah.
Right? But all I could think when I saw the Wendy's, like, I turned on, it's funny, I wasn't watching the TV on, I guess, Saturday it was, right? Or Friday. Yeah. And all of a sudden at night, I'm watching stuff on my PVR, and I turn it off, and it's on CNN, and there's the friggin' Wendy's burning. And all I said, oh, Atlanta burning again. That was all I could see, because we had just gone through a couple of days of Gone with the Wind, right?
Yeah, the
and they're not banning it.
They're not banning it. Of course they're not banning it. They're just taking it off the service, and then they're going to add in, and they're going to do what they always do. They're going to go take it away. They're going to add in an explanatory note by a historian that plays before the film, and then they're going to let you watch the film. And they're just taking it away until they add that.
And what they need to do, is have a commentary.
Let's get Cornell West to come in and do it. Get a film historian and just give us the context for Gone with the Wind. Because it's interesting context. Again, she's a bad person and bad things happen because of her selfishness and arrogance. And that's the whole point of the movie. And by the way, the whole South loses a war because of all of their selfishness and arrogance and the way they treat black people. You know, it's like, it's not a movie that is pro-South, but you're right that the imagery is pretty strong.
Yeah,
and famously, right, David O. Selznick, when he was making it, he was like, I want to make sure that this is, like, he tried his best to make it clear that these were not people to be emulated in the movie, right? He wanted to make a movie that anybody could watch and appreciate, and he knew the sticky racial issues that were coming up because everyone in the movie is a friggin' slave owner, right? They're all slave owners. Yeah. But at the same time, he did what was probably the most frustrating thing for the purposes of marketability. He removed the part... At the end of towards the end of the story, there's a scene where they go to where Ashley and whoever go to a political meeting. And in the book, it's explicit that they're all in the Klan. Mm-hmm. But in the movie, he's like, I can't do that. I like, because no one is going to go see this movie.
If I do that,
if characters are in the Klan, and if I openly try to criticize that.
Yeah, and he's made so much money. He's put so much money into this movie. Yeah, you have read the book.
You have to read the book to understand it even more clearly.
It's terrible. I mean, and do you see anybody? I want to see somebody do Set a Watchman.
Go Set a Watchman,
I want a movie of Go Set a Watchman. Because
if you haven't seen Go Set a Watchman, it's if you haven't read Go Set a Watchman, it's fantastic. And it is Harper Lee writing there's no nice way to say it, the true story of what happened to inspire To Kill a Mockingbird. So there's a fun story about Little House on the Prairie. Which is that, who wrote Little House on the Prairie? Is that Alcott? No, Alcott's Little Women.
No, Wilder.
Laura Wilder. Laura Ingalls Wilder. There we go. Thank you. All right. So she had written a harrowing novel about what it was like growing up on the frontier.
Yeah.
About like the brutality and the awfulness and the fact that her father was a drunk, you know, basically layabout con man who was always, you know, looking for an easy dollar and constantly moving his family around to escape debts. And apparently, I haven't read it, but apparently it's a very good book. No one would publish it. No one wanted to read it. Yeah. They didn't want to hear what it was like in the American West. So what she did was she wrote Little House on the Prairie to be the fantasy version of the American West that everybody wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And we all know how well that did. And so Ghost at a Watchman is the equivalent.
Yeah.
She couldn't tell the true story of her father and the South.
Yeah.
So she told this beautiful fantasy of tolerance within an intolerant system. Right?
Yes.
And that's what it is.
Yeah. And you have Gregory Peck playing this wonderful father. Like, who the hell would call their kid Atticus now?
I know, right?
After Ghost had a Watchman.
No.
Right? Because, of course, he's a Klan member.
Yeah. They're all in the Klan.
Yeah. I mean, he does do this particular...
That case he did, which was not the same case. Like, it's a heavily fictionalized version. It's a much different case.
Yeah.
That he did do the case, and he did defend a black man accused of raping a white woman. Mm-hmm. Well, child. In the real version. Right? And, like, he actually had done this. But he was still a Klan member.
And
her childhood boyfriend is still a Klan member.
Yep.
Sadly, her... Spoiler alert. You find out right at the beginning. Her brother died. So it's very sad, but her brother did die. But it's all there. Like, all of the elements that were, that the fantasy version of them became, To Kill a Mockingbird, and this is the true story.
Yeah,
not and the true I, story, I, but as close to a true story as possible.
Well, yeah, as she's telling this story, right, man? Truman Capote is still Truman Capote.
I know.
You know? But he didn't belong.
No.
Right?
No.
He didn't belong in that world at all. And of course, and she talks about, you know, as she goes, anyway, you have to read Ghost at a Watchman.
It's a great book.
That there are a lot of people that even reading it and knowing that it's probably a more realistic depiction of what was going
actually happened. Yeah.
Okay. She just can't, because everybody loves that movie, To Kill a Mockingbird, and I can't see it anymore.
I know. I'm right there with you. It's tough.
You know, it's not. I wouldn't ban it or anything like that, but I want to see
the whitewashing.
Somebody make Ghost at a Watchman with somebody doing a voiceover. You know, the what's her face? What was her name?
Which one?
The girl.
Oh, God, it's embarrassing. Scout is what she was called.
Okay, with Scout doing sort of this, doing an over, like, I can actually sort of.
Yeah, you could see how it would work.
Like I can, in my head, I can already start doing a
rewrite of it for that.
Well, yeah, a rewrite sort of the book, but also, just pitching,
You start pitching it.
I can start creating a pitch for it, and
quite easily
the rest of it. Like, I would like to see someone do Ghost at a Watchman, because that, and then what you do, I could teach a class and say, okay, let's look at these two.
Oh yeah, it's like the whole story of Americans and how they have to feel about their past is read the fiction, then read the true story, and there you go.
And read these two stories. And read and watch these two
versions
movies.
Of the same story by the same woman. And here's the adaptations, and understand what was the narrative America wanted to say about itself versus what was really happening.
Yeah.
Wow. And, we got pretty far afield from season 13.
I just want to. Okay. Yeah. I got one thing to say, though.
One more thing. Okay? Then I'm going to have to steer us back.
Okay. But I'm going. Because you brought up Little House on the Prairie, right?
I did.
And the minute you said that, I thought to myself, Paper Moon.
Yes.
Right? As well. The lovable con man.
Yep.
The redeemable, lovable con man. Con men. And so many people, I swear to God, who vote for Donald Trump, if you'd asked them if they'd seen Paper Moon way back when, I would be surprised.
No.
You know, and that is too, you know, the lovable con man, for God's sake. Are you my paw?
Jesus.
You know?
Paper Moon's a great movie, by the way, in case you haven't seen it. Paper Moon's a great movie, but...
Ryan O'Neal and Tatum O'Neal.
There is no single narrative that has done worse for America than narratives about sympathetic con men.
Yeah, no, the what you want to see is Elmer Gantry.
Yeah, see, that's an honest story
or
about a con man.
Or you want to see a face in the crowd.
Yeah.
Those are the honest stories about
which, by the way, I love that a face in the crowd is, like, so wonderfully naive because it is imagines that you could, like, find footage of, you know, Lonesome Road saying awful things about his fans and his fans turn on them. But as we learned from Trump, what would really happen in this situation is they would say, yes, we are scum. He's right to insult us. Give us hell. Yeah. You know, Lonesome Rose. That's what would really happen in that situation.
I know. There were so many. But the thing is that people want to believe that people would do the right thing, right?
Yes.
That would happen. It's the same thing as watching the one with Tracy, you know, Katharine Hepburn and Dick, you know, Spencer
Which
Tracy.
One? Yeah, Spencer Tracy and Hepburn, but which one? They were in a lot of movies.
Well, no. The one where she was married to the fascist.
Oh, God, yes. What is that called? Yeah, and he dies, and she finds out that it was a part of an attempt to a fascist takeover of America.
Of America, yeah.
Oh, God, that's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great movie. But anyway, that's getting us off. We should. This is our Sunday show, you know?
I know, right? I think we went off on a tangent and we're sorry about that, but it did come from an honest place of the narrative that you are being sold by Criminal Minds.
Yeah, that's exactly it. This year
of the infallibility.
This year is so bad, and you can actually see it episode by episode by episode.
Getting worse,
like False Flag.
Everything.
Is
no, that False Flag. Look at what's behind. Like, I'm just gonna. I've got it right here in front of me, as do you. Yeah. So before False Flag, Neon Terror. It's their remake of Limelight that's somehow even dumber than Limelight. Right, Dust and Bones.
Yeah.
A decently sensitive episode. The Bunker, kind of a dumb episode.
Yeah. But
Lucky
you know.
Strikes, one of the worst episodes of the year. Killer App. The most ignorant about how the world works episode they've ever made. Which one is Blue Angel? Oh, the one with the sex worker. Right. Which is just, you know, a perfectly average kind of mediocre Criminal Minds episode. To a Better Place. Again, perfectly normal average Criminal Minds episode. And then Wheels Up is the end of Peter Lewis. That's the terrible last Mr. Scratch episode. But look at it. To follow your theory, right? The minute they, if you find out you're getting sued a little before you make False Flag, right?
Yeah.
Like, look at it. So the first one, Peter Lewis, he was a nut bar. To a Better Place, sexual violence against women. Blue Angel, a guy avenging, seeing women as fallen because they're sexually active. Killer App, just a really terrible episode. Lucky Strikes, cannibalism is always sexualized violence. That's just a fact. Especially because they only eat women. You think that's a coincidence. Bunker does not have a sexual component, right? Dust and Bones doesn't really have a sexual component because it's about her abuse. Neon Terror, huge sexual component to the crimes. So 50% of the episodes, right? 100% they're sexually motivated crimes. Because that's honest. That's what profiling is. That's what serial killing is. They're depicting the facts. Okay? 50%. And after that, Full Tilt Boogie. No sexual component. Bad Moon on the Rise. Nope. Cure. Absolutely not.
Submerged.
Miasma. Absolutely not. Annihilator. Yes. That's one. Last Gasp. Yes, that's two. The Capilanos. No. The Dance of Love. Not really.
No.
Ex Parte. Definitely not. All You Can Eat. 100% not. Mixed Signals. 100% not. So in the first 8 episodes, 50% of them accurately depict that it's sexualized violence underlying this. Then lawsuit kicks in, and of the next 14 episodes, only 2 accurately depict sexualized violence. When you first mentioned it, I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. after False Flag happens, the show takes a turn.
Yeah.
And now that we know what was, I mean, I just, when I was writing my reviews, I sure as hell didn't focus on the lack of sexualized violence in the crimes, but I did focus on, you know, how crazy things got after
False Flag.
And as you've pointed out, it is all part of a meta-narrative that the showrunner has created to get out from under this whole lawsuit.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm convinced.
They are both, A, trying to clean up their act in their treatment of, you know, women and sexualized violence, and at the same time, telling stories about how they shouldn't be blamed for any of this.
Yeah. I mean, that is
the two things that are happening right now.
Yeah, like, I haven't got an exact date, but I think what happened, the guy got fired and in 2017, so he would have been, and then he brought the lawsuit.
Some sort of an action.
He found himself a lawyer.
And then he did the arbitration that he's legally required to do.
Well, no, I think it was a slower thing, but I think the papers probably were served.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Because
you serve the papers, then you go into arbitration. That's how it works.
And stuff. But all of that, as you well know, takes a lot of time.
Oh, does it ever.
The government of California didn't get into it at this point.
Until this year, yeah.
Like, not at this point. I don't even think the government of California is really a major part of this, because they each had their separate lawyers, and their lawyers, it would appear, took it to the state.
Yeah.
Decided.
No, so they didn't. No, the California definitely wasn't involved at this point.
Yeah, no, but the lawsuits would have been served. But with the state, once the state took over, they added all of these other anonymous
complaints.
We'll get their names at some point, right?
Yeah.
But basically all of these complaints that were set in, HR must have kicked in around this time as well.
Oh yeah. And so that becomes integral to the kind of stories.
And
that
I'm not even sure whether Breen Fraser and Erica Messer and Glenn Kershaw were fully aware of exactly what they're doing. I think they know some of what they're doing. Like, you know how it is. Like, you know, okay. Like, you sit there and you say, okay, well, I think we maybe better knock off some of this sort of sexual stuff and blah, 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 right?
But then you don't, but you don't even realize how much of your own story you're telling.
Yeah, you're telling in this. Because, remember, there isn't an awful lot of bullying anymore.
Nope, no bullying. But again, look at how we talk about Luke. It's like this wonderful fantasy idea of what if Derek was just a great guy? You know, I mean, I'm not going to say Luke's right about everything. There's a whole episode about him not being right about crucial things. But fundamentally, he's just, what if Derek was a much better guy?
Yeah.
That is really his character. Weird.
It's really weird. Like when you know that there's a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
How that,
and that's entering their think. That must be entering their thinking on some level.
At some level, like it's like you found the Rosetta Stone.
Exactly. Thank you.
To
that
understand,
is the perfect word for it.
Yeah, to understand this season, it makes I mean, I never thought I would have an answer to why this season, because I mean, this
it's
season
so
was,
bad.
Was so bad because I did watch them essentially. I PVR'd them all sort of, and I kind of watched them, but they were so it was so trying to watch. And the next season as well, like 15.
Oh, it's even worse.
But
14's even worse, and 15 is just nuts.
Yeah, you know, but we've already sort of done.
Talked about 15,
On 15, right? And so, and then, but all of a sudden, you get this lawsuit, and you're going. And then I read the whole thing. Every now and then I go back and read it again, because there's little things I want to put in my time chart, timeline.
Yes, your timeline of, reflecting on how the behind the scenes stuff was affecting the show.
Yeah, and it
which is an important chart to, keep an eye on.
You know, BTS, behind the scenes.
Yep.
Right? And having worked, as I said, in a number of hostile work environments because of this kind of abuse, you know, it's just like, it affects everybody.
Yeah.
And even if you're not one of the people being abused, it still affects, because sometimes you are so helpless to do anything about it. I've mm-hmm. talked about that when we talked on our lawsuit. So you can go back and listen to that.
To our lawsuit breakdown. Yeah.
Yeah. But it does affect. Does it explain why the hell, say, Matthew Gray Gubler found an excuse to get out?
He's not in three of the episodes. I love that we didn't even mention that he's not in the first three episodes this week. So yeah. the ones we covered last week. Yeah. When we were talking about them last week, we didn't even mention that Matt Gubler's not in those episodes. Yeah.
Like, he found a way to get off this show for at least 6 months. Yeah. I mean, half of the episodes.
Full half of the episodes this year, he's not in.
Yeah.
And they're still paying him something because he's in the opening credits.
Oh, no, they're still paying him. I bet you.
They're still paying him. But it's like, how did this man cut this deal to not be on the show and still get paid? Like, whoever your agent is, Matt Gubler. I mean, I hope it wasn't for serious personal reasons and he didn't have any injuries. I honestly don't know. But Matt Gubler, whoever your agent is a miracle worker.
Yeah, and he may have been, because I do know that he was going to university to study directing at, stuff. I guess, UCLA or whatever.
Yeah.
So that.
So could maybe that's that factors into it too.
But you know, there's a push to go do that. Like, the thing is, as I said, there are so many things. Anyway, the next time we do a
it is kind of no, it is kind of weird though that we haven't. The one thing we haven't really commented this year, because we do just focus on the plots, and False Flag gave us an in to talk about a lot of meta stuff. But fundamentally, it is strange how little of the show
Reed is in.
Spencer Reed is in anymore.
And not only that, right?
Yeah.
Not only is he not in an awful lot.
Yeah.
But even when he's in, he doesn't have a lot to do.
No, he doesn't do much.
There's the odd one there. Like, where's the one with the clown one? Which one was that?
Yeah, the clown one. Yeah, that was the Capilanos. That was the one episode he was in.
Yeah, and he got to
do the scene with the kid, and he got to direct it, and and he gave himself a good scene with the kid when he was directing the episode. So he still gets to do interesting stuff now and then, but he's largely just not on the show.
Okay, and we'll talk about that when we finish the show, which we should probably do now.
All right. That's a whole other conversation. So yes, that was season 13 of Criminal Minds. It was the worst season yet.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the worst season of Criminal Minds, but it's the worst one yet. And just, that's a spoiler alert for how we're going to feel about season 14. Let's just say season 14 has some stuff to answer for. Yeah. And it's going to be a big question whether we end up saying season 14 or season 15 is worse. I have a feeling it's going to be season 14.
Yeah, because season 15, like when we do it the second time.
Yeah, we'll have a little distance from it.
We'll have some distance from it. And because I do think that when they brought back Ed Bernero to do the one episode.
Yeah, no, it's like clearly they knew that they needed something more to say goodbye to the show.
Yeah.
And that's a conversation we're going to have when we're
reading. Yeah, and besides, as far as I'm concerned, they all don't sit around and around the table and hold hands and thank God for the wonderful blessings he has bestowed on everyone. So, I mean, in that sense.
I know.
I tell you.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're wrong. All right. So, that was Criminal Minds season 13. Thank you for joining us on this trip through it. It's been one hell of a ride.
Okay.
It really has. So we're going to be back here next week with something. We actually haven't discussed what we're going to cover between seasons right now. We haven't gotten into that. So that's a conversation we're going to have after we get off the phone now.
Yeah. We'll blame it on COVID-19.
Yeah, blame it on COVID-19.
We blame everything so sloppy on about COVID-19. This.
But anyway, so yeah, we haven't talked about that, so we're going to be doing something next week. Join us here for that. And then, this is hard to say, but it's like, there's only 10 more episodes of main show Profiling Criminal Minds I guess 11 since, I mean, of the show, of like covering episodes. We're probably going to do a special talking about the show as a whole. We might do a special just about Spencer Reed. Just our character investigation of Spencer Reed. Like, there are going to be specials. There's going to be, and we're going to explain to you how the show is going to keep going after we went out of Criminal Minds. But fundamentally, after the next 10 episodes, there's like 10, 11 episodes. That's it for us reviewing the main show. So I hope you're okay with that. I hope we're okay with that.
We've already got another podcast we're going to start.
Oh, we've got another podcast lined up, but I think we should continue Profiling Criminal
Minds.
Just might not be weekly once Criminal Minds is done.
Yeah.
That's the big thing. We might not be a weekly podcast anymore. But you know what? That's 8 months in the future for us. So we got plenty of time to figure this out.
Yeah, work it out.
We'll figure something out.
By the way,
if you're worried, no, we're not going anywhere just because we're out of Criminal Minds. If you were worried about that.
There's lots of stuff.
Oh, there is.
There is. It was just that we got so... It was obsessive. There was no question. So that's why we started this damn podcast. And then it got so... it hadn't gotten really, really bad when we started the podcast. And then it just went way off the rails.
Right off a cliff.
Boy, if they were still hanging on to the top of the cliff, right?
With their fingernails.
And then wham. That was it.
And I was going to say, then the cliff.
How far down?
And then I was going to say the cliff broke away. But no, they blew up the cliff. They blew up the cliff.
Yeah, they did.
All right. So that's that. We'll see you back here next week for something. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have any profiling related fiction you want to suggest for us to cover once we're done with Criminal Minds, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We will see you back here next week and in 2 weeks' time, starting season 14 with what three episodes?
Oh, you mean I'm going to have to go and look these up, eh?
I'm going to look them up. I'm going to do it for once.
Okay.
300, their 300th episode. Wow. Starter Home, which is about the guy who has mummies under his porch. And Rule 34, a very important episode for understanding who Emily Prentice is. And I'm not going to say one more word about that until we get there, because it's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say, don't be shocked if the first episode of season 14 is 2 full hours long. There's a lot to talk about. All right, so we'll see you back here for that. But until then, I want to say thanks for watching. If you're listening on a pod catcher or some kind of client, be sure to rate and review, because that's how people find the show. We'll see you back here next week. But until then, au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.